Welcome back again, ladies and gentlemen. Laszlo Montgomery, still with you after all these years. Thanks for coming back. Part 6 this time in our sky-high overview of the history of the Thai Chinese. Not quite reaching Felix Baumgartner heights, but still pretty high up, looking down nonetheless. We got as far as the reign of Siam's King Rama VI, King Vajravut. He was the one on duty to witness not just the fall of the Qing dynasty and the triumph of republicanism, well, sort of, in China, but also the emergence in 1921 of the favorite bête noire of all monarchists and liberal, democratic-minded people everywhere, the Communist Party of China. Both their association with republicanism or communism, no matter how tenuous or non-existent it may have been for many, the ethnic Chinese residents of the Kingdom of Siam are going to be made to pay one way or another for the events unfolding in their ancestral homeland. And in this episode, we'll look at some of the challenges they faced in the Kingdom of Siam during this most complicated and, up to that time, destructive of periods in world history. So we left off last time with the King of Siam, Rama VI, calling out the Chinese inhabitants of his kingdom for their similarities to the Jews of Europe. What could be worse than that, right? And if the royal monarch was going around inferring stuff like this, and what this meant, well, all those who agreed with the king on the inside but never dared reveal their hidden feelings for the Chinese in Siam before, well, now it was okay to vent. And this venting came in all shapes and forms. It all stemmed from this new kind of Siamese nationalism espoused by King Vajravut, Rama VI. The long-running, cozy, political and economic alliance between the monarchy and the ethnic Chinese movers and shakers of the kingdom, now that started to become a relic of the past. And as Siam became more and more integrated with the world trade and financial system, commerce and industry inside the kingdom adapted. What used to be a myriad of small enterprises that had served commerce and industry so well in the past began to transform into bigger and more sophisticated operations that quickly grew into powerful national and regional entities. And these entities were more readily equipped to engage in matters of international trading and finance. The real story happening by this time was not so much in industry and manufacturing as much as it was in agriculture. Saudi Arabia has its oil, China, rare earths, South Africa has its gold, and Zambia its cobalt, Madagascar, of course, with its vanilla. These marquee natural resources make up only a part of a nation's profile. Now, the Kingdom of Siam, their great blessing, was with its agriculture in general, and rice in particular. Even today, we all know fragrant Thai jasmine rice. I can't remember a time in the past few decades when I didn't have at least a 10-pound bag of that in my kitchen. Thai rice. They grew a lot of it. And the regional and global demand was quite great. The concerted effort of the government and Siam's rice farmers to build the country's rice export industry was one of the greatest successes the nation had ever seen. From a modest 100,000 tons exported in 1860, this grew to over 1 million tons of rice per year exported to the world. And remember last episode where I mentioned that the government of Siam funded their own railroads and, you know, didn't fall into any infrastructure or debt traps like what happened in China and elsewhere? Well, it was mostly due to the revenue the government raked in on export taxes on rice that provided the funding. Siamese farmers made a lot of money growing rice. They weren't like the poor peasants in China. The government provided the impetus to these rural agriculturalists by opening up all this fertile land surrounding the Chao Phraya Delta. Rice production skyrocketed and lit the fuse for this boom in Thai rice exports. But an export boom is not achieved by rice farming and harvesting alone. That was only the front end part of the industry. There was that part of it, the farming part. And then there was everything else that went into the rice business before those grains made it to your rice bowl. The Thai farmers grew the rice. But as far as everything else in the rice business was concerned, Chinese merchants took care of all the post-harvest end of the business. Many urbanites take the farming aspect of our food for granted, but there's a lot that happens after the farmer cashes his check from the buyer of his crop. There was the milling, the sales and marketing, financing, the transport and logistics. There was a lot to it. And the Chinese of Siam who engaged in that business had all that locked up. From soup to nuts, they made it all happen. And the Siamese farmer, who was utterly dependent on the Chinese, to get their crop to market. Chinese merchants would wander into every single hamlet of the rice-growing regions and deal individually with every farmer, striking bargains for their crop, and you could be sure that these intrepid merchants, besides arranging the purchasing of the farmer's rice, also sold a variety of manufactures to the farmer that were difficult to obtain out in their neck of the woods. So they not only bought the farmer's rice, they did a brisk business with these rural peasants, selling them many of the necessities of life. The milling, foreigners tried to get a piece of that action, but the Chinese rice millers dominated this end of the business, and Europeans operating in Siam got bought out or squeezed out. The milling process involved removing or separating the husk, the bran, and the germ from the rice kernels. Siam, Burma, India, these were the powerhouse rice exporters of the early 20th century, and the ports of Singapore and Hong Kong acted as the redistribution centers that exported the rice to every single market. And what you began to see, as far as the Chinese business community went at least, was something different than in the past. The great tycoons and most esteemed and prosperous Chinese families in Siam had mostly all owed their exalted positions to marriage alliances and special relationships with the Siam monarchy. By making these alliances with the royal house in Bangkok, these Chow Sua, Chow Mong families enjoyed preferential treatment to dominate whatever businesses they engaged in. Well, not anymore. As the 20th century began, as I think I mentioned last time, the mechanics of international trade started to become a little bit too complex and interconnected with other economies, and a whole new level of sophistication was required to be a player in that game. And nowhere was this more apparent than in the rice export trade. And the ones who dominated the rice business in Siam were the Diochu-run companies. No surprise there. And as went the fortunes of the rice business, so went the economic well-being of the Kingdom of Siam. That's how important rice was to the big picture. And in their dying years, the Manchus reached out to the overseas Chinese, including those in Siam, and tried to belatedly enlist their support. Going back to the Ming Dynasty, those Chinese who left China for other lands were spurned and even considered criminals. Now, not so much. The overseas Chinese of Nanyang had become so formidable in their commercial and financial success, they not only became a major source of financial support for the dynasty, but political support as well. In 1909, better late than never, the Qing court passed the nationality law that tried to call all overseas Chinese as their own, even though they were mostly all full-time residents of their adoptive country by now. And in the case of Siam, no diplomatic relations existed yet with China. To entice them, the Manchus would hand out honorary titles and all the trappings of honor to any overseas Chinese who would pony up some financing or show support for the dynasty. And even though everyone knew it didn't really add up to much, those tycoons and big shots in the Siam Chinese community, who could afford it? Well, they wrapped themselves up in these robes, hats, and symbols of imperial favor. Who cared if the dynasty was on its last legs? These things look great in photos hanging in the family photo gallery, and later generations would look at these photos and recall the respect given to their ancestors by the Emperor of China, who was only 2 or 3 years old at the time. But in reality, trying to win over the overseas Chinese of Southeast Asia was too little too late, and by 1912, there was a new sheriff in town. And besides, the King of Siam and the government, they weren't so thrilled about surrendering the nationality and loyalties of their ethnic Chinese subjects. Tax farming, that system that had done so well for the kingdom following the introduction of free trade in the wake of the Baoring Treaty, that started to take a back seat to a more bureaucratic and modern system of taxation, utilizing civil servants that worked a lot better for the government, and I'm thinking probably for the Siamese paying the taxes. By 1909, tax farming was retired after a nice, long run, going all the way back to King Rama III. The thing about nationalism that many leaders often underestimated is that it's easy to turn it on, but terribly difficult to put out when it starts to flame out of control. And because of all the nationalism that started brewing during King Vajiravut's time, the Chinese, and even the monarchy to some extent, well, they started to feel some heat. Because in Siam, at least, disparaging the Chinese sort of went hand in hand with the nationalism. And one other small thing that had big consequences, well, after the fall of the Qing, Chinese women began to follow their menfolk out to Siam, or they came alone or in groups, plying the same steamer routes. You know, up till then, if you were some Hokkien guy trying his luck out in Siam, and you wanted to find yourself a Chinese wife, lots of luck, baby. Chances were slim to none. But not after 1911. It was a new world for China. And although it took a while to fall into the groove, women started emigrating. And once it became easier to find a Chinese wife, well, let's just say they were heavily favored over local Thai women. And under this kind of dynamic, well, the odds of the husband assimilating to mainstream Thai culture, it became a lot less probable. For many reasons, the fall of the despised Manchu ruling dynasty and the establishment of the Republic of China led to a big wave of loyalty and patriotism, especially from the overseas Chinese of Nanyang. There were many who still clung to the emperor for dear life, but for most, the Manchu ruling house was way past its sell-by date. Fundraising for the motherland became a constant task, and the organizing of these efforts went to various community leaders who were all business tycoons. And as we saw last time, following the Bangkok strike that happened in 1912, after 600 years or more of living side by side with the Siamese, the Chinese began facing a new kind of reality that put them on the defensive for years to come. They were declared disloyal to the monarchy and therefore to the whole country. Their enthusiasm to help the new China, compared to the Siamese nation, was pointed to as proof of their lack of concern. Any kind of support they showed for Sun Yat-sen, the Republic of China, or the whole idea of republicanism made them suspect of having divided loyalties. And after 1921, after the founding of the Communist Party of China and the introduction of this ideology to the streets of Bangkok, it turned up the heat even further. The Chinese of Siam were not only spread out over various linguistic groups, they also differed in their politics as well. Though most supported Sun Yat-sen, plenty also lent support to various warlord factions or to Sun's political rivals. A very vigorous debate was carried out in the plethora of Chinese language newspapers that were read on the streets of Bangkok and other major cities. The KMT ran a very well-oiled machine in Bangkok. They had the most money, most support from both community leaders and the Chinese on the street, and they wielded the most influence. And after the Shanghai Massacre of April 1927, when the streets of China were no longer safe for communists and leftists, many fled overseas, mostly to Southeast Asia, where they regrouped and spread the word about their new up-and-coming ideology. In March of 1930, Ho Chi Minh traveled to Thailand to do some organizing, and helped establish the Communist Party of Siam. And even though most ethnic Chinese did not embrace this political ideology, nor did they join up, still, they found themselves being accused of supporting them, or at least sympathizing with the communists, which didn't do anything to help alleviate the cloud of suspicion that hung over the Chinese residents of the country. In November 1925, Rama VI's brother, King Prachatipok, was crowned the new monarch and became King Rama VII. He had to deal with quite a lot of things during his time on the throne. The Great Depression, for one thing, had knocked the entire nation of Siam for a loop. The impact on the economy was profound, to say the least. And then in the throes of the Depression in 1932 came the revolution that toppled the monarchy in Siam, or more accurately, downgraded the king's power and authority from absolute to constitutional monarch. The coup was led by Siamese officials and the military. And one of the leaders who came to be the face of the new post-1932 revolution in Siam was Plek Phibunsongkhram, a name that was simply too much of a mouthful for some in the Western press. So he was mostly known in the West as Field Marshal Phibun. He had been a Royal Military Academy grad without any illustrious relatives who could grease the wheels for him. He studied overseas in France and fell in with a group of guys who would later join him in plotting the coup. What followed the 1932 revolution was a major facelift for Siam. There was this rush to transform the country into a modern nation modeled on the West, with a sophisticated government and bureaucracy, as well as military, led by elites in each power base. Everything that had begun with King Mangkhut in the 1850s and 60s and carried even further during the reigns of Chulalongkorn and Vajiravut were now being taken to the next level under this new government. All these decades, the Siamese monarchy had made an unofficial alliance with the country's Chinese subjects. But after the tail started wagging the dog, so to speak, particularly in the case of the 1912 Bangkok general strike, the King of Siam turned to the military as a new best friend. And now in 1932, starting on June 24th, the King of Siam was done in by them. And as we all know, both nature and power abhor vacuums. And standing by, ready to fill the power vacuum, was a new bureaucratic and military elite who coalesced around a center. And things were ran, sometimes benevolently, sometimes not so benevolently. These military officers who comprised the topmost layers in the Siam military were German-trained, very dedicated, and the feeling amongst this group was that the Western colonialists, i.e. Britain and France, they were the real adversaries, and it was them that the nation had to be wary of. And besides that, those two European countries had never been forgiven for the terms of the 1826 Burney Treaty that, among other things, took the states of Kedah, Kelantan, Perlis, Terengganu, and Patani and folded them into that Malayan operation the British had going on down there. As many a conqueror and successful coup plotter figures out sooner or later, it's one thing to tear down and destroy. The hard part was to, well, presumably do a better and more equitable job than your predecessor who you just overthrew, namely, the king. And not to get too deep into Thai history, the main reason I'm mentioning the 1932 revolution is because, for the Chinese of Siam, it was all downhill from there, at least for a while. A long while, you might say. Chinese emigrated to cities and towns all over the world, we know that. But from this series, I want you all to appreciate the one thing that made Thailand a special case when it came to its ethnic Chinese minority. From part one, we remember the Thai people, T-A-I, who migrated to present-day Thailand from southwest China, and how, well, since the Mongol Yuan dynasty in the 13th and 14th centuries, Chinese people had been coming to Thailand practically nonstop. So even before The biggest waves of emigration happened in the late 19th and early 20th century. There was already quite a sizable number of Chinese. And who was Chinese and who wasn't? Well, if everyone sent a vial of spit to the folks at 23andMe, the amount of Chinese DNA that could be gleaned from everyone living in between Chiang Rai and Yala province, well, it wasn't a small number. And in this one respect, Thailand has always been special in the world. Estimates vary, but as much as 40% of the people in Thailand have some of that Chinese DNA, whether they have any feelings for China or not. And now they were all being tested. Now the time had come to smoke out all the Chinese of Siam and get them to line up, either on the side of the king and country or on the side of China. This was going to be the cudgel that would, whenever convenient, would be used on members of the Chinese community or the community at large to get them to do the right thing, which was love this country you live and work in, and not the one your parents came from. And with all the excitement, the visiting dignitaries from China, the fall of the warlords, the rise of Chiang Kai-shek, the communists, desperately trying to make a comeback following their evacuation of Jinggangshan and Jiangxi province. These were heady days. And after Japan invaded Manchuria on 9/18/1931, that ratcheted up the heat a few thousand degrees Kelvin. And there was a clear differentiation made between the Hua Qiao, overseas Chinese immigrants, and the Lokchin Chinese, who had long assimilated and identified completely as Thai. There was a place for them in the new Siam. And Phibun and the other leaders in the revolution, well, they had plenty of Chinese ethnicity in their family going way back, but they spurned the Chinese for every kind of perceived disloyalty to the country, including all the money earned in the kingdom that was remitted back to China, or stayed inside their community, or sent back either to families or to all these political causes they backed. And in these post-Great Depression years, Siam was having a heck of a time trying to bounce back from these economic hard times. They too got hit by the after effects just like most everyone else. And they were trying like crazy to turn things around and not being too terribly successful. And in times like this, rather than admit one's own shortcomings or lack of a plan, the easy way out is to find a scapegoat and point to that as the ultimate cause for all the hard times everyone was putting up with, and that many Chinese were doing just fine while so many others, i.e. the local Thai majority, were not. I'm going to turn the Chinese into the perfect punching bag. And Phibun, along with the People's Party that he led, was going to get a few left hooks in. So with Japan now well into its march of folly, and for a long time now doing a brisk business in Siam, they started to sniff around and gauge the situation. They knew what they were doing in China wasn't going to make a lot of friends over in Bangkok's Chinatown and the other predominantly Chinese parts of the country. The overall feeling was decidedly anti-Japanese, very much so. Everyone knew what Japan was up to in Manchuria. And it wasn't even 1937 yet. After 1937, when Japan went at it full bore in China, the fundraising, the speeches, the visiting dignitaries, there was excitement in the air on the streets of Bangkok and the other commercial centers about fellow Siamese Chinese banding together, rising up and doing their patriotic duty to their ancestral homeland in this most dire of ours. And part and parcel with all this patriotic duty to help China went all kinds of manifestations of anti-Japanese expression. This came in the form of boycotts and railing against Japan in the press. And Phibun and his government, they did not like that. Though he'll live to regret it later on, Phibun and his group opted to line up on Japan's side. They bought into the whole Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere thing, and truly believed there was a place for Siam in this brave new world. And though he hadn't asked for anything just yet, he had his eyes on those territories he had to give back to France and Britain. With Japan's help, maybe they'd become part of Siam again. And for their pugnacious anti-Japanese talk, Phibun would hammer away at the Chinese, beginning with what's always the lowest-hanging fruits of suppression, the prohibition or limitation of Chinese language education, closing down Chinese language newspapers, journals. Man, back then, before the internet, it was so easy. And support for Japan during the 1930s and into 1940 became the bellwether that determined your patriotism towards the Siamese nation. Those who were against Japan were against the government and the King of Siam. Yeah, it's not like every single Chinese in Siam felt the same way about every single issue. Even amongst the Chinese, there was bitter division. We remember those years from 1911 to 1949 as 38 years of chaos and violence in China with so many competing factions contending for power. Each and every one of those factions in China had their branches and supporters in Siam. So just to reiterate, the Chinese community in Siam did not speak with one single voice. The Chinese Chamber of Commerce in Bangkok emerged as a sort of a mouthpiece for the Chinese community. Not everyone agreed with them, but they sort of, by default, became the ones who got dressed down by the Japanese or the government or given ultimatums and orders. And if the Chinese Chamber didn't show sufficient zeal in supporting and promoting the government's policies, with regard to Japan, that is, they heard about it. And besides, Phibun had outlawed any anti-Japanese actions that might be organized by Chinese community leaders, be they communist organizers or KMT organizers or whoever. And all the fundraising that was being carried out at a furious clip. Well, needless to say, Phibun and the Japanese, well, they tended to frown on any local Chinese fundraising efforts, no matter what prohibitions were put in place. Wherever there was a will, there was a way. And the Chinese of Siam poured a lot of money into aiding China's war effort. Up to 1941, remember, China alone had been fighting back against Japan. They were it. The Flying Tigers, the AVG, American Volunteer Group, they only came just right before Pearl Harbor. So China, starting in 1937, was facing the Japanese onslaught when Japan was at its most powerful, most well-armed, and equipped. But after the Japanese took Shantou in January 1939, the port was closed to any war relief supplies. There were more Chinese in Bangkok than Japanese, and resistors banded together in their various groups. I guess you could say up until the bitter end in the summer of 1945, the Chinese of Siam did their damnedest to make life miserable for Japan there, commercially and otherwise. When a strike was called for, you actually had enforcers out there who would mess up any Chinese who chose to defy the orders from on high and continue dealing with the Japanese. February 1938, all the ringleaders who had been the most vocal in their anti-Japanese rhetoric and doing most of the organizing, well, they were rounded up and incarcerated. And then in 1939, that was a banner year, Phibun changed the name of the country from Siam to Thailand, the land of the Thais. And this government-sponsored Thai nationalism was going at a full boil. Chinese language schools shuttered. All Chinese newspapers, all but one, out of business. One by one came the prohibitions, insults, and other stuff that helped to make the chasm between Thailand's ethnic Chinese minority and the government more and more unbridgeable. And in that nasty year of 1939, three Chinese community giants were assassinated within months of each other. And there were other things happening that weren't terribly beneficial to the Chinese. Certain jobs were reserved only for Thais, and Chinese living in certain parts of Thailand were made to leave, even if they had been living there for generations. And in the next episode, we will continue on with Phibun's further adventures and his capacity of Commander-in-Chief of the Royal Thai Army. He was effectively the dictator. But as we'll see, the Japanese were constantly whispering in his ear and becoming a major pain in the you-know-what. So please, don't give up the ship just yet. I think we could finish this topic off next time in Part 7. But there's one thing I wanted to cover. I never got to it, so I'm thinking in Part 8, I'll rewind and cover one topic that's sort of a standalone, but since it has to do with the history of the Thai Chinese, I may as well insert it here as sort of a bonus episode. And according to my overpriced marketing consultants I keep on retainer, they told me clearly an 8-part series sounds way better than a 7-part series. Plus, you know, 8 is one less syllable. This here is Laszlo Montgomery signing off from Los Angeles, California. Do join me next time, won't you, for another exciting episode of the China History Podcast.